Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. And of course, I'm Al Warren. Mr. Joe Goldberg is sitting here talking.
I'm sitting here talking. I'm looking out the window ready for the snow to fall. Ooh, snow's falling in Chicago.
No.
Shut down. Well, they're supposed to, but everyone shut down the roads, right?
Yeah. Well, you know.
Does it snow where you are?
No. Nothing. It's raining. No. Nothing but rain. It's Canada. Canada doesn't snow.
Yeah, not anymore.
No snow in Canada. It's tropical. Oh, it's crazy.
Give it a couple of years.
Yeah. Get a suntan all year. Well, let's get in. Now, today we have a writer joining us today, and his book is called Scavenger Hunt, and it's a novel. He's got quite a history, and it looks like quite a book. So, Mr. Chad Boudreau, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Chad, you have quite a history of working in different government agencies and it's just all sorts of things here, like Homeland Security. You've got, shipbuilder. You've got all this stuff. So what made you kind of get away from that and get into the writing into a novel?
Well, I really started writing as I was developing my career. So I never stopped and then started writing. It's always been just a parallel universe that I've lived in, if you will. I had my dream job when I was 28 working for the Department of Justice. And I kind of stumbled into that. And as I stumbled into it, I really was just in awe with the environment. It was right after 9/11. We were in Washington, D.C. It was a very harrowing experience. And as a part of that, I just started writing. I had a great Dane named Judge, who is actually in the book. It's the only real character in the book. And my wife was pregnant with our first child, and it kept me up at night. So as a part of being up at night, I would just take out my old something just north of a TRS-80 computer, I think,
Holy
at the
cow.
Time, and started typing away.
The so boat anchor.
That's where it started. Yeah.
Well, what was it that you were trying to get out of the writing? Were you were just writing for yourself and you were trying to work through things, you think, in your mind? Or was this something that you wanted to eventually put out? Did you know that back then?
Yeah, I didn't really know what it was. I think it's a little easier for me to articulate now. And it's just almost like a psychological release. It's, you know, you're in the legal world, at least, you're always writing precisely. you're writing in a formulaic way that's not as creative. And I think just being able to put the rules aside when work is over and have the ability to decompress and think of a good story and just kind of let the creativity flow from there was always something that calmed me down and it excited me. So I kept doing it.
So you're kind of getting a lot of it. So when you say it calmed you down and stuff, or were you being very personal in what you were writing, or was it completely to escape what you were doing?
Yeah, it was something short of escapism, but it was definitely, some form of escape. I think, and I just want to be clear with that word that can be misused sometimes. But for me, I think the best way to describe it was I would show up at the main justice building pretty much every day in a period of time when, national security was everywhere. It was right after the terrorist attacks on 9/11. And I was amazed at the building in which I worked. I was amazed at what I was seeing around me. And I needed a way, an outlet to write that down and to memorialize it. It was, for me, I've said this before as a part of this book, but, I was looking at a building, an historic building, that had 7 floors on the inside, but it looked like 8 floors from the outside. And so I was always trying to figure out what that 8th floor was all about or what the windows were all about. And I couldn't figure it out. I did research, couldn't figure it out. And finally, I met someone who told me that used to be the FBI ballistics lab. And so I went, found a custodian, asked him to get me up there. And there's literally a secret staircase that gets you to the 8th floor. Now it's more of an attic with a bunch of heavy equipment up there. But I walked around with that individual and he actually knew a lot about it. And it's when I saw that and I was able to walk that top floor is when I really felt like I needed to write a book.
Wow. How does completing this book change you? Like when you have completed it, now you're doing the promo tour and this is going to come out to people. How do you think the writing process actually changed you?
Well, I think that, once you get a book published, I think, there's some validation there. There's, there's different stages that I think change you as a part of the process. Once you're trying to find a publisher, maybe an agent, that's a hard part. That's a learning experience. I think you become a better writer when you go through that process. There's really no shortcuts to that I know of for good writing. And so most of the authors that I speak to now in the author community, they all have these stories of how hard it was to break through. And once you break through, to answer your question directly, it changes you because that's what people want to talk about. I mean, I always thought I had a pretty cool job, no matter what job I was in growing up and, getting older. But it doesn't matter if I'm chief legal officer of a Fortune 500 publicly traded company or if I'm working at the Department of Justice, what people want to talk about is the book. They want to know about it. They want to know when it's coming out. They want to know what it's about. And so that's kind of fun. And it's interesting because that's what I would rather talk about, quite frankly.
Yeah, I concur with that because people's like, they're in awe that you have a book on the shelves. They can hold it in their hand. They treat you like, Shakespeare. You've got something done and it's some mystical, magical thing. It's kind of refreshing in some sense or motivating and strange when they treat you in that way. So that's a good experience, right? You like that experience?
It is. And so I'm curious what you think about it. I've always tried to figure out, what's causing people to be so interested in it. I think there's some people that are just generally interested and who like to read. I think for the most part, however, the people that I talk to are aspiring writers in their own regard. And they want to know, how did you do it? They always ask the question, how long did it take you? How did you get started? It's always the how to and when did you find time? Those kinds of questions. And then normally, probably I would say 50% of the time on the heels of that, they'll say, I have a story. I've always wanted to write a book, And so I think it's hard. It's hard for people to finish it. I think it requires, a dedication and time commitment that some, for whatever reason, find hard to get to.
They probably want to be a part of it, right?
Yes.
Well, certainly my family, they all want to know, like, well, who's that person? Why didn't you name me? Why didn't my name be there?
I'm an anagram now. Thank you.
That's
Thank
right.
you very much.
Right.
Yeah, I think people want to, they know you. It's, there's, you know, your name's on a thing that's on the shelf, and you know, they have a story to tell, as you say. Just, it's, you want to motivate people. You want to talk to them. You want to say, here's how it's done, right? You want to be supportive of the people who were trying, thinking about things when that were, that was you 3 years ago or 5 years ago. You want to be supportive, right?
You do. And it's hard because you want, everybody tells you when you, when you're trying to get published, when you're trying to finish the book, whatever the milestone is, they're always telling you, you have to just keep at it. You know, don't give up. If you keep at it, eventually things will happen. And for most people that sounds, yeah, that sounds right. But I don't know if I really trust it. And I want to tell people you have to trust it because the going through the hard part actually improves your writing, which in turn makes you more marketable. And there's that process that I think is required. And so I really want people to believe that, but I'm not so sure that just saying it will get the job done.
So in your book, like I'll talk about me, my first book was basically fiction autobiography. Is this book, you know, writing, the phrase is write what you know, right? Is this writing what you know?
Absolutely. So this is, and that's the fun part, is I didn't have to do a whole lot of research for, you know, to get the plot right. The book itself, what I say is it's a spy thriller. It's got a strong national security background. I don't want to call it a terrorist book because it's not a terrorist or a terrorism book per se, but that is a backdrop. I don't want to call it a legal thriller, although you're going to learn a lot about the law if you're reading it, particularly national security law. But there are nonfiction books that if you really want to learn about those things, you can go pull off the shelf. You will learn a lot about that in this book from my own personal experience, but the book is really meant to be entertainment. And if I don't capture the reader and entertain the reader from the very beginning until the end, then I've failed. But hopefully along the way, some of the things that I've lived through, the experiences that I know about will come through the book. And I think they have in Scavenger Hunt.
Such as
the tension between national security and privacy, that, you know, there are factions on this side that are very passionate about increasing national security or maintaining privacy. We really saw that, you know, back in the 2003, 2004 era with the Privacy Act and whether or not we were going to reauthorize the Privacy Act. You know, the Privacy Act had all of these provisions in it that helped law enforcement and intelligence, you know, go after bad guys. And it was normally for the, you know, for certain things that we would have for the mafia or otherwise that were now, they were trying to put on the more of the national terrorism piece, and they needed more tools. But the privacy groups were also saying, well, hold on a second, because we don't want our privacy upended by all of this. And so what the book does, I think, is it puts the characters in this spot where they are doing outrageous things in a real setting where those tensions come to light and you're able to analyze them in a way that I don't think bogs the story down, but it just really, you're living the moment of what it would look like if you were under increased scrutiny and you had to do things that otherwise you wouldn't want to do. And in doing that, you really put those tensions right in the middle of the story.
I have to wonder then, when you're focusing on a real event, or when a real event is kind of the backdrop, you know, with things so, I don't know what, I don't want to get too political, but with things so talked about these days, did you try to not direct it at any one meaning, any one group or another? Like, do you know what I'm saying? So like when you're talking about security and then you're talking about privacy and stuff like that, they can be deemed political. Are you trying to stay out of that and not really give a direction for your readers?
Correct. So I do have, you know, viewpoints, and some of them are passionate, more passionate than others. But in this world, I really do. I think that there are good arguments to be made on both sides. So I really try to draw that out. I think, you know, I really learned this, you know, when I went over to the Homeland Security Department, and Michael Chertoff was the secretary at the time. And that was a new department. We were meeting with groups from both sides. being with strong national security groups, and we were meeting with strong privacy groups, and including those that represented different cultures that, you know, if you're not careful, can be prejudiced by all of this. And so I learned at an early age that you need to take in all points of view. And you know what? It's, if you just play it down the middle, it'll take care of itself. I mean, I mentioned earlier the Patriot Act. If you'll recall, back in the era that I talked about, 2003, 2004, it was really the national security hawks that wanted that passed. And now, today, with the politics of today and all that's gone on since then, it's that group that's saying, "Hey, we don't need the Patriot Act, you know, anymore like we did." And so it's kind of interesting to see how that's transitioned and evolved over time.
So did you write this with some sort of subtext or meaning behind it, something underneath the entertainment that you hope your reader gets, or did you avoid that?
You know, I think it comes out, but I first and foremost wanted to write an entertaining story that was based on topics that I really enjoyed and that interested me. And I wanted to make sure that from the first page until the very last, that the reader couldn't put down the book. And, you know, if I look back at it now, I can say, well, you might find a subtext here. I don't think you're going to find a political subtext that leans towards one party or another. You'll probably find, you know, the fact that I, you know, love what I do. And I love, you know, living in a country where we can have these debates. And I think a lot of that is you know, expanded on in the book.
Chad, you come from a world of legal and government that are pretty much rigid and built upon, you know, process, procedure, and policies. Is that how you write your books? Do you use that same sort of mentality when you're trying to put down this, you know, complex stuff in an entertaining manner?
Yeah. So let me just first say that as relates to the plot of my book, that's the main problem that they have, is they can't get past the bureaucracy. But they can't move fast enough to stop terrorists from doing X, Y, or Z. And so they're taking inordinate measures, extraordinary measures. And that's where the tension in the book comes and starts driving things. So I probably did. We talk about subtext. There was probably a little bit of me post 9/11 where I was saying, we've got too much bureaucracy here. We need to tear down this or whatever in order to save people. There was, you know, I was 28 years old. I probably had a lot of that. But in writing the book itself, I love the fact that there are no rules. There are no rules in writing fiction. I love that. But there has to be structure for me. I have to have structure in order to make it work. And what I mean by that is, if I don't know when I start out what my title is, that's going to bother me. I need to know, generally speaking, how many words I'm going to have in a book. The answer to that for me is probably around 100,000 words. And I even say I probably will aim for 50 chapters. And that structure is just enough for me to say, I need 2,000 words for this chapter. I need to have this many chapters by the end of the week or the month. And that gives me, so I don't know if that's bureaucracy or just a little OCD, but it definitely is required for me to function. And so love it within that structure, kind of going crazy and not having the rules that I have in my legal writing. But certainly I need that structure.
It also gives you the flexibility, especially like in to end it the way you want and to have certain amount of justice, accomplished in the book when you write fiction rather than when you're writing 100% legal or truth, right?
That's right. That's right. I will say this. I push my lawyers now, both the ones that work for me inside my company and the ones we hire in law firms, to really be creative, even within the legal briefs now, because I just think that's what judges are used to seeing when they read stuff they want to read. And so it used to be very formulaic back in the day, this language of comes now, you know, here comes now plaintiff. And now it's, you know, Bob was hit by the car and, you know, nobody cared about him. So it's even creeping into my legal writing. And I think it's actually made that more effective, actually.
Right, right. People relate to it. So your characters, how do you create your characters, because you're writing a lot about things you've experienced, and you're taking from a lot of your own, you know, day-to-day actions with people and stuff. So are these characters from people you've worked with or been around during different events, or are they completely something you create in your mind?
I start with a pretty strong core with each character and characteristics that I pull from others. And then they kind of grow from and develop from there. So the protagonist in Scavenger Hunt is a lawyer that works for the Attorney General of the United States. His name is Blake Hudson. And Blake is a Supreme Court, former Supreme Court clerk, who is very young to be in the position that he's in. So I was very young to be in the position that I was in, but I was not a Supreme Court clerk, but I worked with a lot of them. And so I was drawing from that. There's very few people at the Department of Justice in the positions that Blake are in that are not like top of their class at one of the top law schools. And so so I took all those characteristics from people with whom I worked. And I think Blake's an amalgamation of many of those. He's also got a lot of the trial lawyer in me. And so that kind of blends in nicely, I think, with the more academic side that that he also has. And that allows him to function at a high level with a lot of horsepower, but he's also fun and a little bit unpredictable.
A lot of people that we interview talk about their fictional characters as if they know them, like they're real. And they experience them, hear voices sometimes, whatever. What's your experience when you're writing your characters?
Yeah, so I think for me, one of the best books I've ever read on writing is On Writing by Stephen King. And I think Stephen King is one of the best at creating characters, at least that I can relate to. And when I first read On Writing, he talks in that book about your characters being put into an incredible situation where they have to get out, and it's, and their characters kind of do what they want to do. And you don't have a whole lot of control over how they're going to react to the situation. When I first read that, I kind of rolled my eyes and I said, that's the hokey stuff that is not helpful to me. But after I wrote Scavenger Hunt, and as I've finished my second book, even last week, I really believe that now. And I don't know, it's probably just a psychological blip, but for me, I put my characters in crazy situations. And I tell them, you need to find a way to get out of it. And as I think about them getting out of it, they end up doing things that I had not planned that they would do. So back to the structure piece. One of the things that I do when I write is with those 50 chapters I talked about, I will give some semblance of an outline for each of those chapters before I begin my book. And that's more, it's more, I would say, scaffolding than anything else. But about halfway through the book, the scaffolding really changes. Sometimes I have to break it down and build it back up because my characters have done stuff that I did not anticipate that they would do. Now, it's always better, but it's not always predictable.
So your characters are running the show.
They really mess up a good outline, I can tell you that.
They surprise you.
They do surprise me. I had one that was this, you know, sweet woman in my last book, and she's become very devious and, you know, really caused a lot of havoc. But boy, it's fun writing about her now.
It sounds like though you are writing for escapism, you also have a great love for the work that you've done, like the jobs you've had, like you really have a passion for them and stuff. How do you feel about when you're writing and you're following this kind of book, a lot of public feeling toward law enforcement and justice and stuff like this isn't so positive lately.
Yeah. I think, I think that there are two sides to it, and depending on, you know, where you are in a particular crisis or where you are just location wise, you know, you need to look at the facts of each.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Situation. So I support law enforcement, but I also support restrictions on law enforcement. So I think in our society, we really try to make things binary. And that's what I really want people who read Scavenger Hunt. If there's any challenge, I want them, any subtext coming out of that, it's probably this. These are not easy questions. These are not black and white questions. They're hard. They're really hard. I'll just give you an example. One of the political things that I see now is relating to immigration coming on our southern border. I know a lot about, the Canadian U.S. border that you're familiar with. So, and you may be familiar with the southern border as well. I spent a lot of time on the southern border when I was at DHS. And it really changed me. It changed me because I was a law enforcement person. I still support law enforcement. But what I found when I got down there is there's a human element to this that nobody's talking about. They'll talk about it conceptually, but here's a specific example. We heard about children in cages, all right? And really what that means is that children have been detained and put in ICE facilities or marshal facilities on the border. Nobody wants that. Okay, but the way you characterize it is important. When I was at DHS, one of the problems that we found, we would get briefed by the intelligence agencies, and I used to get an unclassified briefing in addition to the classified briefing, specifically targeted to the criminal gangs in northern Mexico and the immigration system, if you will, on that southern border, stretched 4 states. And you would see all sorts of trend data coming out. You would hear anecdotes. Well, one of the things that we were seeing back in 2005 and 6 were children in Mexico were getting kidnapped without ransom. We had no idea why that was happening. And so the more we pressed into it, we learned that the human smugglers, they call them coyotes, but human smugglers in northern Mexico had figured out that we had a loophole in our immigration system, whereby if you came in as a family unit, then they would either they would give you really a notice to come to a court hearing, and then they let you free inside the country just automatically. And so there you go. You would be able to come in as a family unit. And the reason for they do that is for humanitarian reasons. You don't want to separate families. And so what happened was is the human smugglers started stealing little kids in northern Mexico and marrying them up with couples, I put that around quote air quotes, to force them to go in as a family unit or to pose them as a family unit. And the kids had trouble keeping up. And so they would feed them Ephedra in 100+ degree heat, obviously dehydrates you very quickly. And we were finding dead bodies in both deserts in northern Mexico and in southern United States with children who were not being buried. That is a very macabre real fact that you don't hear a lot about, but that was one of the reasons why, we were always trying to figure out ways to deter people from that family unit coming across as a family unit when it led to that kind of kidnapping. So just a very terrible, terrible situation that when I saw this coming back with the kids in cages things, I worried not only about that, but just about the practice itself that I just referred to. But those are not questions where you point fingers at people and say, how dare you do this? How do you do that? That's a problem that needs to be solved by sober people who have children's and families' interest in their heart. And so that's, when I look at the politics of things, that's kind of the way I try to look at it sober-mindedly, because normally, again, it's not as binary as we make it out to be.
It's a tragic story and you hear it, but I ask you as a writer, how much is that realism do you try to get into your books? That's that granular sense of place and feel and time that make people react.
Yeah. So I try to put people in that place and time as much specificity as I can without dragging my story down. My first draft of Scavenger Hunt had detail after detail of the main justice building, because that's a building that most people have never been inside. It was one of the prettiest buildings in our country, certainly in DC. And again, there's just a lot of artwork and there's a lot of architecture in there that people will never see. So I really wanted to give a good picture of that. And about a quarter of it made it in. I mean, after more sophisticated editors than I am looked at it, they said, I think you painted the picture very well without, dragging us down to the details. But so I'm always very cautious not to do that. But yeah, I hope that, when people read my book, when I read others' books, I want to be in that place and time and I want to see what's around me.
What did you find to be the biggest struggle of writing?
Finishing.
How did you know when you were done?
Let's go there. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so how do you know when the book is done? Like for you?
So I'll tell you what I've said before is it took me 18 months over 20 years to write Scavenger Hunt. So, in the latest book that I wrote, 9 months. And so it goes to editor tomorrow. So, I think it does get better. I think it's a learning process. You need to get your confidence. You need people along the way to tell you don't quit, because you don't share too early. But when you share, people are going to respond, and you need to take criticism in stride. You need to have thick skin, all those things. But for me, I think you do the best you can. You get a final together. You know, it's not going to be perfect. You have to say it's not going to be perfect. When you're writing 100,000 words, not every word is going to be the perfect word, right? And you just hope you get it right most of the time. And then you have a date, hopefully, where you're going to submit your manuscript for publication. And that's when you think it's over. Now I almost have to correct myself on the fly here, because for Scavenger Hunt, I had this amazing thing happen. It got picked up for publication. I had, worked with the editor. I'd gotten it to a point where I was really happy with it and turned it in. And it was that time where you're like, okay, now we're going to go celebrate. We've turned it in. And I went on a business trip to DC, and on my business trip to DC, I was in an event and I ran into 3 former attorneys general of the United States. And I knew 2 of them, and one of them I had worked for, and he was asking me about my book. And I said, I just sent it in. And then another one came and he said, hey, what's this book about? And I'm saying, I'm glad you asked. So, talking about my book, and I was talking about the hidden 8th floor, like I just told you about. And then one of them turns to me and says, well, did you know about the hidden apartment above the Attorney General suite? And I almost fell down. I said, no, I did not know about that. And all of them, to a person, started talking about this room where Robert Kennedy, not JFK, would take Marilyn Monroe above the suite. And so I, in this book, so I got all the details I could of this. And just listening to these former attorneys general describe other things in that office that I'd been in, but I did never really paid attention. And I didn't know about that top room. And just walking through that, I called the publisher when I got home and I said, stop the press. I've got two more pages I've got to write.
Oh boy.
There's got to be something about, there's so much conspiracy out there too with government and government agents and also with, public figures like Marilyn Monroe and stuff. I guess it must be pretty interesting being in that kind of a field.
I think so. I mean, it's funny because we all read spy thrillers too. And so some of the novelists have never been there, probably more exciting than what the actual work is. But yeah, there's a lot of intrigue, I think, particularly overseas. You know, here we have, at least in the United States, probably North America in general, you know, it's pretty controlled. But when you get overseas and you've got a lot of other things going on, you really get like into the case officer world of the CIA. I think that's where people really get interested. Of course, the FBI is always interesting, and it's fun to craft stories around either of those agencies.
Yeah, as a former kind of case officer, it's not very interesting to write about balancing out your cash box. You know, nobody really wants to read about that.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, it's a thrill. Yeah.
Who do you read then? You talk about some spy novels and stuff. Who do you like to read?
Yeah, my favorite is Robert Ludlum. And unfortunately, he's no longer with us. But I love Tom Clancy. I love the details of Tom Clancy. Brad Meltzer is another one, particularly his early works. He wrote a book called The Tenth Justice that I was reading about the time when I started writing. So I have to say that was probably inspirational for me as well. I knew some people that had worked in the White House counsel's office at the time. And so that was fascinating to me. So I'm sorry. He had the 10th Justice, but the one that was First Counsel was the one that he came out with after that one. And it was about a lawyer inside the White House counsel's office, but both fascinating books to me. And so that's where I, actually I do read other books that are popular, like Dan Brown. I started reading a few of his books recently, just because I wanted to know. I saw his masterclass, and I thought his masterclass on writing thrillers was really good. And I'd never really spent a whole lot of time in his books. I think I'd read, maybe his first two, but I bought a bunch of those books and read some of those. And I like the way he thinks about writing. And so, that was interesting to me. And then Nelson DeMille is, am I pronouncing his name correctly? I had never read any of his books before. And, he wrote one called The Cuban Affair that I just picked up, and the writing was so rich that I really fell in love with it. So I just ordered a few more of his books, and I'm really looking forward to, once I get this last book submitted to the publication, you know, spending some time with his writing.
You should really read Joe Goldberg's books.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to plug me. Thank you very much. You'd be the first one.
Yeah, come on. What are you doing? That's the best writer I know.
Best writer on this podcast besides Chad. Yeah. And you. I'm third.
Al, Chad. I'm good. All
right. I will say, too, not so much with the horror, but with his other fiction, I really like Stephen King. I loved his Dark Tower series, and I read that I think within 1 year on the DC Metro, but just going back and forth from work. But it was very interesting because I was reading, forgot which one I was reading, maybe Needful Things, and I was in an airport. This was last year, And it was the I was traveling with my boss. So we were in the private, we were in the general aviation section, the one where you don't have to go through security at Dulles. And I'm waiting for our plane, our pilot to get there. And lo and behold, walking towards me is none other than Stephen King. And I've got his book in my backpack. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be that guy. I want
to be the guy. Be the guy.
I
don't want
to
be
that guy. But I said, I got to say something. So he gets close to me. And I didn't know at the time, but he was there for, they were having an antitrust case, I think, on some of the publishing companies that are trying to consolidate. And that's why he was there to testify. But I didn't know why he was there at the time. Anyway, he comes to me and I'm thinking, I can't let this opportunity pass. So he got close and he looked at me. He knew that I'd recognized that he was famous. And I just said, hey man, I got Needful Things in my backpack. And he said, good man, and pat me on the shoulder. that was the closest I've come to, you know, the Hall of Fame.
That's fame. That's fame. That's it. Stop. Stop it right there.
Yeah, that's funny. Should have asked him to sign your back or something, you know, yeah. Sign my arm.
I've seen some of his Twitter activity and he did not look like he was in the best of moods, and I did not want to be on the wrong side of that. So
what's your plans here? You said you've got another book done. Is this part of a series, that kind of thing, or what, how are you, writing now? Like what's going on?
So I'm doing, you know, my aim is one a year, and again, my publishing company is not, they let me go on my own time. So that's nice. But, just in terms of going back to that structure and discipline, that's what my aim will be. And so, the latest book is not in the series. It's just a general thriller, but I felt like I really needed to write it because I couldn't quit thinking about it. And it was really howling the loudest. And so, very happy to get that done. But the response to Scavenger Hunt has been so good, particularly with advanced readers and some of the critics, that they've asked, you know, when are you going to write another one in the series? And so my next book for 2023 that I'm writing will be in the Scavenger series. And I'm doing research on it right now. So, and I will have to research this one a little bit more.
Beat must involve Canadians.
There's nothing to research there. No, you start running out of autobiography, right?
Poutine.
Well, so the Canadian, I'll just tell you this, as a Boudreaux, I did, my wife bought me Ancestry.com a few years ago, and I'd never grown up with my dad. He died early. And so I grew up in Southern Texas and not Louisiana, where most of the Boudreaux live. But I traced my ancestry back to France, obviously. But we went through which is now Halifax. And, you know, the group that we were with persecuted pretty hard there by the British. And, so yeah, I've got some Canadian roots. I have not been to Halifax, and, but I'm planning to do that in the next couple of years so I can go see what the, father's side of the family was all about.
When you're writing, it sounds like you're very outlined, very structured. You've got all this pattern set up. Does your mood affect this then? So when things are really kind of stressful and something's going on that's not happy around you or with people around you and stuff, does that kind of affect your writing, or do you just push through and write anyway?
I've never really thought about it. I try to be as consistent as I can because I know if I take too many breaks, and I write early in the morning before everybody wakes up, and then I'll usually read late at night. After everybody goes to bed, and I still have three kids in the house. So that's my time. And then my work schedule will depend. My work schedule can be very hectic. And of course that takes priority. So if we're hot and heavy at work, then writing goes on the shelf. But when I have the time and I am, I'm normally in the right frame of mind. Of course I have days where I have emotions like anybody else. And does that make it into my story? Probably. I think the best way for me to measure that is through the music that I'm listening to. And, you know, if I'm listening to Pearl Jam, you know, I'm probably in a heavy action scene, and, you know, something else is probably different, but yeah, I like to listen to music, and the music often reflects the mood that I'm in.
But let me ask you, a question about the research and the autobiographic part. How much do you think about your reader? As I know you want to entertain, but you are writing in an area where there's a lot of people who know some things, and they're going to go, oh, no, Chad, that's not how that works. You know, it's a blue, not green. It's the third piece of paper. How much do you think about those kind of readers, the one that are inside your world and the readers outside your world?
Right. So for Scavenger Hunt, I had some amazing pros review my book ahead of time. And you know, including, you know, Secretary Chertoff, John Ashcroft, who was the U.S. Attorney General, people on really both sides of the aisle, but also the career folks at the Department of Justice who had, you know, just knew everything, all the history that I needed to know. There were some mistakes that I made early on, and you have to have thick skin, believe me. Some are kinder than others when they correct you, but we did everything we could to get it right. I think at some point when you're writing, you will get comfortable in your area. For Scavenger Hunt, again, it was not an area where I thought I had to do a lot of research. I did do some just to get the technical pieces right. But, you know, for anything that I'm doing, I think anything that you're writing, I think you do your best you can to learn about your subject. It's obviously better if you're an expert in the field. And then you need to socialize it with the people who know. And you got to be careful not to do it too early. But at some point, you got to ask a lot of questions. You almost have to be an investigative reporter. And then at some point, you can write it and share it, and they'll let you know if you got it right or not. Nobody, they're not shy. Experts are not shy, as you know, to tell you when you're wrong in their area. So
okay. So are you going to be set up to interact with people? Have you got a lot of social media set up and a website and all that? How do you want your fans and readers to find you?
Yeah, I think the easiest thing, other than just going on, to your favorite bookstore and buying the book directly, is, just go to my website. It's chadboudreaux.com, chadboudreaux.com. And you'll have everything there that we're doing. We'll be, the book goes live on January 31st. So for those listening live or near live, that's Monday. And so, and then after that, we've got a couple of tours that we're doing and other things that we're doing, but we're excited.
Well, fantastic. Of course, we'll have that up on the website. People can find you with one click, and that'll be easy for them. So how was it? You must've been writing some of this over the pandemic. How was that?
Well, I've got to tell you, the pandemic, I have different views about that. My first day on the job, in my new job as chief legal officer of my company, was really right at the time we'd set up a crisis management meeting at our company for the pandemic, and we were early. So I didn't have much room to write or even breathe during that time. I think over time, it's, obviously some have figured out better than others how to structure their day to where they can be productive. In the legal community, I'll just say this as an aside, we have a big problem with stay at home. And that's because, particularly in the manufacturing industry, because you really need to be next to your client. Most people are allergic to lawyers anyway. And so you need to... they're not going to call you up from home if they, when they're having a business meeting. So in order for lawyers to really be at their best, the most efficient and most persuasive, they need to be with their client. So at my company, we're very clear that if you've got some issues with your family or whatever, that is priority, take care of it, stay at home, and we'll make do. But eventually you got to come back because, particularly for lawyers, I think we're going to be hurt by people staying at home. And unfortunately, not a lot of people are talking about those issues.
Something I think just society has to work through, something that, people have to learn, what works and what doesn't. So strange. Anyway, well, it's been really interesting. So now the book, of course, we're talking about is Scavenger Hunt, a novel. And our guest is the writer, Chad Boudreaux. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests,
hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.